You know ID in the D in the L O A. ID in the D in the F E A. You know ID in the D in the L O A. ID in the D in the F E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 210 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual now from different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of your Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks. And back and better than ever, 72-win season. Here we go! Wearing the 23.
Yeah, I guess that's true. This is your 96th season. Last week was your number 45, is not number 23.
I can episode. Feel it, too. I can feel it.
All right, well, we got a lot to get to this week. I mean, not really from 2020, of course, but still got a lot to get to. Let's start with some toasts. What are we toasting with this week?
I am drinking. Or you say what you're drinking first, actually.
Yeah, that's true. I am drinking from our friends at Silver City Brewery in Silverdale, Washington.
There we go.
The Ripe and Juicy Double IPA.
Ripe and Juicy, hello. And I am drinking from our very good friends at Georgetown Brewing Company in Georgetown, Washington. What may be the best beer in Washington State? Johnny Utah Pale Ale.
That is a high bar to climb. So we've got So we've got some news to toast from our friends at Georgetown Brewing, because they made a big announcement last week. As people were speculating might be the case, they have decided to can Manny's Pale Ale for the first time ever.
Wow,
from their Facebook page. Well, it looks like some of you guys guessed it. Actually, pretty much all of you, really. The limited six-week run of six packs of Manny's Pale Ale should be available at the brewery beginning Saturday, May 23rd, and available in Washington stores starting Wednesday, May 27th. Keep an eye out here, and we will let you know as soon as they are ready to go. So why can Manny's
What are
now?
Your plans on Saturday, May 23rd?
I think they're going to go to the brewery, probably.
Canny's, baby.
We'll let Manny explain it below. I thought you'd never can Manny's. Well, we also never thought our world would be devastated by a global pandemic. When we started canning beer at Georgetown Brewery, we figured leaving Manny's Pale Ale as a draft-only beer would help us stay connected to the foundation of our business, the bars and restaurants that first served our beer. If you want a pint of Manny's, you have to go out, be social, and support your local bar or restaurant. That's why for our first 14 years in business, we only sold kegs. It was also our excuse to drink beer at bars and call it, quote, work. Now more than ever, your local bar and restaurant needs your help. They have always been there for you. They have fed you, they have provided shelter, they have kept you hydrated, and your favorite bartender has listened to every one of your stupid stories. It's time to return the favor. 100% of our profits from the sale of Manny's cans will go to support bar and restaurant workers throughout the state of Washington. These cans are a limited release, and when this pandemic ends, we'll see you at the bar for a pint and a cheers, Manny and Roger.
Man, I kind of got goosebumps there for a second. Look at this. 100% of profits.
Yeah, definitely a great cause, a great beer for a great cause. Also, this has always been my take. Do you feel like Roger's a little bitter that he got the Pilsner that isn't nearly as like notably good as
Manny's? Roger, I call him Rogers. Roger's bummed. And rightfully so. I mean, Manny's is the beer, right? But at first when I heard that Manny's was being canned, I had kind of the same reaction that Manny's is having, where it's like, well, there's something so unique to it being exclusive to bars. Right, it's like this is our beer. You know what I mean? Like this isn't you just pick it up randomly. Like you have to work a little bit. You have to be a little bit cool to care about Manny's. And now that it's in cans, I was like, okay. But hearing that description, I'm like, oh, I was totally wrong.
Yeah.
You know, you can throw that out the window, because a limited release during this crazy time period benefiting bars and restaurants, this is huge. We're going to be drinking a lot of that in the coming weeks.
I will see how limited the release is and how much we'll be drinking. But definitely, again, a toast to Georgetown Brewing for that decision. I did pick up – I had a growler of Manny's last week, so that was quite good.
There we go.
All right, next up as far as toasts go, We want to toast our friends John Boyce and Alex Rubenstein for the conclusion of their Dorktown History of the Seattle Mariners 6-part series. The final section, giddy a bit emotional. Not a lot of success on the field to celebrate, obviously, but just kind of glorying in Mariners fans continuing to follow the team and the delightful oddness that has been the Seattle Mariners in the past decade.
Kind of magical seeing this come to a conclusion the same week as the last Dance.
Yeah, similar levels of success between the Mariners and the Bulls during the 90s.
It really is the two polar opposites. It's like the Mariners always found a way to lose despite expectations, and Jordan always found a way to win. Like, these are the two polar opposites of sports in general, right? Like, the Bulls won the most games ever, and then they won the championship. And the Mariners won the most games ever, and they didn't even make the World Series.
It is really all true.
It's a Mariners story.
I did connect these. I don't know if you remember this, going to the Mariners game the night that Steve Kerr made the shot to end the 97 finals.
Absolutely. Uncle Steve took us.
I thought so, yes. Okay, I do remember that too. I don't remember the game at all where, as I noted on Twitter, Randy Johnson had 12 strikeouts in 8 innings, giving up just 1 run. Edgar Martinez 3-for-4 with a homer. Mariners beat the Colorado Rockies 6-1 in interleague play.
Wow, interleague play.
That might have been the first or second year of interleague.
It was exciting at the time. Like, yes. It's still an interesting thing.
It's lost a lot of novelty.
I remember hearing about the Steve Kerr shot more than I remember the baseball game that we were at.
Did they show it on Diamond Vision between innings? I have to assume that's what happened.
I don't think they did. I think Steve told us about it. I think he had gone because he was like, I'm going to go have a beer or whatever, which at the time I was just like, you're doing what? As a 10 or 11 year old, I was just like, oh God.
Well,
he's a good for nothing.
No, not that wasn't the issue, that he was drinking a beer. Our dad, you know, loved a good Rainier, but our family was never drinking a beer at the games because our mom would never allow us to pay those prices.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we were children, of course. But
oh yes, but we weren't getting hot dogs. We were getting sodas. So we're coming to sort of a natural endpoint for Let's Remember Some Years. I feel like we should go up through the start of the Pelton cast. So 2012 was the last year pre-Pelton cast. And then, like, we didn't conceive of this as a thing that was going to go on indefinitely. So
supposed to last for the 90s.
I mean, originally we were just thinking of it as because UW men's basketball wasn't any good this year, not as something that was going to take us through a hiatus.
People don't remember, right? Like, the other podcasts who are doing stuff like this, they merely adopted this, right? We were born into Let's Remember Some Years. We were doing Let's Remember Some Years. We were molded by it. We were doing Let's Remember Some Years before the quarantine. That's the thing. We haven't changed all that much. This is who the past is. We ain't changing for this shit.
So there's a few possible ideas I've been kicking around. So one is we could go backwards. There's a couple options.
Kick some of those ideas my way?
That's what I'm doing right now.
Okay.
So we could start from the period where we like really got serious about these and started doing notes and doing playlists and go backwards from then. We could also start going backwards from 1992, which is the first year we didn't remember. Although if we do that, we're pretty quickly going to run out of years that we actually remember.
Uh-huh. I just feel like the personal aspect here is more important than, like, you know, this isn't fucking Time Life over here or something, right? Like, it's more VH1's Best Week Ever than it is just like a retrospective of things that happened, right? This is about the personal element of it.
I'm
a little bit skeptical.
You're going to compare it to a show like this and not go with I Love the 80s?
Well, it's basically the same thing.
Yeah.
What is that dude? Hal Sparks?
Yes. Wow.
I'm him.
Can I be Michael Ian Black?
I guess so.
So another thought I had, I mean, there's a lot of different directions we could go. But another thought I had is, like, talking about the experience of attending various different sporty events, because that's not something we usually specifically talk about on the podcast. And I think that could be fun, particularly for the listener that is not in Seattle, to get that kind of perspective. And then also even for people who are in Seattle, if we, like, talk about what it was like attending Mariners games at the Kingdome or something like that.
Interesting. So you're saying we recap that day where the Sonics won against the Suns and the Seahawks went to the Super Bowl and Kobe scored 81 again?
Yes. Yeah, we're going to do like a 24 – or like, you know those pods where they take a minute of a movie and analyze it? Mm-hmm. We're going to do that with that day, minute by minute.
Oh, my God.
All right, so anyways, tweet us your feedback.
So you're saying the experience of, like, what it was like on sort of, like, a granular level of, like, going to Safeco Field or going to the Kingdome or working at a Sonics game?
No, I mean, like, for me? Yeah, I guess that could be interesting, too. Yeah.
On a functional level, because you've experienced it, it's just, like, what is your day like when you're reporting on a game for ESPN? Or for when you were working with the team with the Sonics or Storm, like, what are you doing in the day leading up to it?
Okay, yeah, that could be interesting.
I mean, I could also talk about it with regards to, like, what it's like the lead up to, like, not a big concert, but, like, to concerts, you know? Like, what is your day like?
Ooh, that is a good crossover.
Yeah.
We'll just talk about all these live events that we can't possibly do right now.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
Okay, well, speaking of the listener who's not in Seattle, we have a listener email from across the pond.
Oh, my God.
From the listener, Alan McCarthy. Hi, Kevin Tristan. My name is Alan, and I am from Cork, Ireland. Somehow a number of years back, I began listening to the Pelton Cast, probably after Kevin plugged it on Twitter. I'm a bit of an NBA junkie, so I've followed your writing for a long time. I was hooked very quickly once I checked out the Pelton Cast and have been listening devoutly since. This probably sounds insane to you guys, given that I have zero ties to the Pacific Northwest. I spent summer 2016 in Vancouver, but that's about it. I really enjoy the rapport you have with each other, and this is what really kept me listening. The Seattle Sports Talk is great, and it's been
least favorite part, of course.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting way to follow U.S. sports for me. I love when you guys talk music and really enjoy Tristan's insider perspective. Same goes for the food talk and your search for Seattle's best burger / ramen / sandwich, etc. You best believe that I plan on visiting Seattle at some point. I'm going to add an editorial note. Hopefully when we do a live show again. And eating my body weight in food. Haha. Long story short, I just wanted to give you a shout out and thank you for being a consistently great podcast. I listen in every week. Again, I probably sound like a total nutter, but I just enjoy listening to your passion for your city. My hometown, Cork, is pretty small, maybe 500,000 including the suburbs, but I can really relate to the feelings you have for Seattle. We have a great emerging food scene, some really passionate sports fans, and some great people too. In these weird quarantine times, I just wanted to send some messages of appreciation to some of my favorite creators. I can't explain how great it is to have the weekly 90 minutes of back and forth between you guys. Hope you guys are keeping safe and well. Keep up the great work. Alan.
Wow! Cheers to you, Alan. Hello!
Absolutely.
My favorite part is being considered a creator.
I mean, it is tough for me to understand the interest from people who have zero ties whatsoever to Seattle. But at the same time, like, I am so much more appreciative of that and that you're enjoying what we're doing because of the fact that you're not at all the audience that we're, you know, expecting this to appeal to. If you're a guy in his mid to late 30s from Seattle who likes sports, like, it totally checks out that Ben is our third Pelton brother. But for someone that doesn't have that connection to enjoy it is awesome and really, really rewarding, I would say.
Well, thanks so much for listening, Alan. I mean, I think... we love hearing from everybody who's listening. It feels sometimes like nobody is. And sometimes nobody is. But we definitely like hearing about that and definitely appreciate you reaching out. So we'll definitely be toasting to you right now in Cork, Ireland.
There you go. It's a little late in Coke Island.
And along with Alan, as always, we should be toasting to the frontline workers.
Absolutely.
But also, I do have to say, like, I feel like you're different than me in this way, and that I'll listen to, like, I listen to Rewatchables podcasts about movies that I've never seen before and have no plans of seeing ever in the future. And it's just like, I just want to listen to these people talking, right? Like, if you give me Chris Ryan and Sean Fennessy, like, I just want to listen to them talking about whatever, whether I understand the context or not. It's like, I can figure out what Young Guns was about or something. But most importantly, I just want to be there and be hanging out with, you know, Chris Ryan and Sean Fennessy and people like that.
And enjoy the banter.
Yeah.
Did you figure out what Draft Day was about?
It was about the Seahawks getting roasted on some trades and losing their punt returner.
Yeah, a super valuable punt returner.
About a team drafting a running back and a linebacker with two top 10 picks. So
sure was.
Maybe the Seahawks didn't get quite – because the Seahawks drafted the quarterback, right? They drafted Bowen, yeah. Whatever. Yeah, the Seahawks still, in the end, won the day.
Unless he's not any good.
Whatever. I mean, even a not any good quarterback is still better than drafting a running back and a middle linebacker with two top 10 picks.
I don't know if I go that far, but it's a better value proposition, certainly a better process from that standpoint. I was on the ESPN Daily podcast with Third Belden brother Mina Kimes today.
Name dropping again.
Yeah. I mean, she's been on the podcast. Like, is it a name drop when we have her on?
There was not even a context for you to bring up the ESPN Daily podcast.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say that before it, we were discussing Draft Day.
Wow. And they cut that from the podcast?
Sadly, yes. Did not keep that in.
Hashtag the Pelton cast would never.
We would definitely have thrown it at the end. They've got a little bit of a different editorial style at ESPN Daily than we do.
A couple we more would have listeners. Said to ourselves, this is great content. We can't lose this.
Stay tuned after today's show.
ESPN Daily doesn't think every single conversation they have is great content quite like we do.
Probably not.
Lord.
All right, we're going to flip it this week and do 2020 sports talk first, and then let's remember some years. So the quick roundup. Sounders FC have been given approval to begin individual workouts at their training facility at Starfire in Tukwila. Still not anything group. The actual facility itself is not really open in a real sense, but much like we've seen with NBA teams, including the Blazers, being able to have players come into the gym to just shoot around on those baskets with one assistant coach who is, you know, staying socially distanced and wearing gloves and a mask, something similar will now be possible for the Sounders players as they just try to keep in shape during the hiatus.
I feel like this is an important step of being at the facility, doing stuff that replicates sports. I feel like this is progress. Have we heard anything about MLS's decision or like what they're expecting to do? I mean, we saw the Bundesliga start back up this week, and obviously the situation in Germany definitely different than it is in Seattle or in the United States. But have we heard any rumblings about what MLS's plans are?
Yeah, the latest talk is that they plan to play at Walt Disney World, and initially the idea is that they would play a tournament with a group stage and then a single elimination knockout.
Just from the get-go? Huh. Okay.
So that would – the planning is that teams – I've seen the ESPN report here. Teams, players, and staff would head to Orlando around June 1st. The first month would see teams train with games taking place in the second month.
Interesting.
And then I guess then you'd evaluate from there where you would go.
I mean, that feels pretty difficult for a season that is as long as MLS's season is to just go straight into a tournament. Rather than, I mean, we've seen the Sounders – and granted, whatever, we're in unique circumstances. But, like, we've seen the Sounders have months of average play that leads to months of
We're actually
MLS Cup caliber play.
We're going to remember a season like this coming up shortly, as it turns out.
They kind of all are now. But, like, if you're going straight, who knows what you're going to get for the Sounders? Between, are you going to have the good Sounders or the bad Sounders if you start a tournament right away?
But my guess at their logic is that it's, look, we don't know whether there's going to be a second wave, whether there's going to be, you know, an upswing because of seasonality in the fall. So let's try to get at least a trophy handed out and then figure it out after that is my guess.
Interesting.
At their logic.
Would this be considered, would they consider this the MLS Cup trophy, or would this be similar to the Open Cup type of thing?
Unclear. I mean, it certainly wouldn't be the Open Cup because it's not open. But
yeah.
Something in between, I guess. But
that is,
you know,
a fascinating idea.
It would also give you like some way to, you know, handle the Champions League next year, things like that.
What is the latest on, assuming we're done with the Sounders, what is the latest with the NBA in general for somebody who's not paying as much attention?
Still not any specifics being offered by the NBA. The sense is they're looking at both the Disney World Wide World of Sports complex in Orlando and then Vegas.
Is that a options. Different complex than MLS
no.
is looking at?
No, I think
same
it's the
one.
Same.
Okay.
They just have both basketball courts and soccer fields there.
Okay.
And the possibility that they might use both of those locations, but beyond that, not a lot of specifics other than optimism.
Well, so the difference between what MLS is doing and the NBA is doing is, like, the NBA is talking about playing additional regular season games plus getting in a full playoffs, right? That's kind of the chatter.
That's the hope, yeah.
Which we're talking, like, seven-game series first round in the playoffs.
Yeah, it would certainly be a longer time frame. I don't know if they're going to play an entire regular season out, but a longer time frame
they play
than MLS is talking
some
about.
Regular season games.
You almost certainly wouldn't want to go directly into the playoffs, whether those are exhibition games or regular season games. I mean, at that point, they probably should be regular season games so that they count for your local TV deals.
Have you ever watched NBA basketball without fans?
I went to the 2007 Summer League.
Like, is the viewing experience, what do you think that would be like with no fans?
Also, I mean, you know, we've talked about this in the past. The G League Showcase is one of the models that, you know, from a logistical standpoint, they're looking at in Vegas, where they have the two courts set up there. The only fans are, you know, members of the players' families and, you know, VIPs, that sort of thing. Like, there's not a true crowd in any real sense at those. I mean, you know, the energy is not the same, certainly, but it's something that can be done. And I think there is a difference. You mentioned Bundesliga, and there's a lot of talk. I didn't actually watch those games, but saw some of the highlights, obviously, on Twitter. Like, you know, they're filming those like any other games. You're getting these shots of a bunch of empty seats, or just, you know, I guess rows in Germany, where they often have standing stadiums. But, you know, if you're going to an entirely different venue, it probably won't be as noticeably empty.
Yeah. I mean, I think about playing basketball, right? And when you're playing basketball, like, the energy comes from playing the game. Like, maybe it'll be weird for a little while, but eventually you're just playing basketball. And people always talk about, you know, watching this Jordan documentary, like, people talk about these legendary practices with the Space Jam training and with the Dream Team training. And it's like, there were no fans for those situations. And they're talking that this was the highest quality of basketball anybody had ever seen. I don't know if it's as dependent on fans as people think it is, you know, and like that maybe home court matters a little bit less, or maybe even a lot bit less because of that. But like,
well, I mean, there is no home court. They're going to be on neutral sites, so yes.
I think that aspect of it will be pretty fascinating. But, like, aside from that, the basketball is probably not going to look all that different. And we might even hear, like, a little bit more chatter between the players. It might be a different viewing experience that's even positive in some ways.
Yeah, and I think that's another difference between basketball and soccer is, like, there's not the same concept of, like, you want to be right at the edge of the pitch so that you can monitor what's going on between the players or something like that, in the same way that, you know, if you're front row courtside in the NBA, that's a huge part of the experience.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about the NFL, right? And we talked about there was that choir in Kitsap County or whatever where it's, like, basically every single person ended up with...
Snohomish County.
It was Snohomish County, where basically every single person ended up with coronavirus because they're singing, right? And if one person had it, it's just like the droplets were spreading everywhere. I was thinking about an NFL game or even a college football game where literally you just yell for so much of the game. And it was like, that is just not more so than any other sport, right? Every single defensive play, you're yelling out droplets. Whereas, like, I think that's going to be a really difficult situation to manage. But the NBA is definitely a little bit different. Yes. So, anyway, I guess we look forward to covering those and, you know, hope that if they do play some regular season games that the Blazers have a chance to try to sneak into the playoffs. Is Nurkic, let's say that they do play games, is Nurk coming back?
I mean, he'd have the full, whatever, you know, training camp period.
Who is healthy and who isn't healthy for the Blazers then? Obviously, Rodney Hood is down, right?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen specific updates. You would think Zach Collins by this point would have had plenty of time to recover from his shoulder injury. That talk was, you know, back some point, end of March, give or take. Dirk, you'll recall, was set to play. His first game was scheduled to be 4 days after the shutdown.
Ugh, God.
Huh. He should be fully healthy by this point, you would think.
Interesting.
I don't know that they would have gotten anyone else back. And was there anyone else injured long term? I guess not. Just Hood.
It seemed like everybody.
It did. But plenty of time to monitor that and see what's coming from the NBA and MLS as well as MLB, which is the only league that's talking about actually traveling city to city when they resume play this summer. On the Seahawks front, the big news of the past week is that cornerback Quentin Dunbar surrendered Sunday to an arrest warrant on 4 charges of armed robbery stemming from a dice game that also involved Giants cornerback DeAndre Baker, who was charged both with armed robbery and aggravated assault with a firearm. Dunbar was granted $100,000 bail on Sunday and released. His attorney, Michael Grieco, presented during that trial, or during that hearing, I should say, affidavits from 5 of the state's witnesses disputing the charges against Dunbar. So kind of a very confusing 48 hours between an extremely aggressive public relations affront by the Miramar Police Department in Florida, and then in... perhaps even stronger pushback from Dunbar's attorney via social media.
And I guess we'll continue monitoring the situation as we go forward. I mean, it'll be fascinating to see how this evolves. It feels like, you know, like, honestly, these are relatively unknown players, and it does feel like the story's gotten a little bit blown out of proportion given that there's no sports news happening. Whereas, like, this is the only sports news, so everybody has to cover it. But as it is, there's definitely a lot of unknowns, especially with regard to Quentin Dunbar.
He doesn't seem as centrally involved as DeAndre Baker was in this incident, as reflected by the different charges against them. But, you know, still a lot of unknowns. And I was irked, I would say, by the way that people jumped to conclusions about, you know, the Seahawks aren't going to have Quentin Dunbar this season as soon as the arrest warrant was made public via the Miramar Police Department's Twitter account, because that's a totally normal thing in 2020. One of my distinct pet peeves is both sides litigating cases in the media because of the fact that those facts don't have to be checked by anyone in the same way that there's, you know, a check from the judge and, you know, objections and things like that in a courtroom. So it's not a very good way, I think, to assess someone's guilt or innocence.
Yep. Well, it's also you're a due process guy, right?
I am, yes.
Yeah, you're a big fan of due process. You always have been.
It's kind of foundational to our justice system.
Yeah, I really respect that about you. And I do think that this, everything that's happening with regards to like playing out the social media aspects of this are ignoring the idea of due process. And that to me is like, it's all just wait and see. We don't know at this point.
It's okay to not know. The other Seahawks news of the past week, our friend Bill Barnwell, third Pelton brother, Bill Barnwell, came out with his the bottom eight installment of his NFL offseason rankings as he works through those. And your Seattle Seahawks were in there, ranked 26th by Barnwell.
Okay. What was the general logic of... I know he really... It was the Agboihe signing that he hated. I feel like there was one that he hated of the offensive line, of the numerous offensive linemen, that Barnwell hated more than the other signings.
Yes, he did hate the Agboihe signing, although that didn't get mentioned really too much in here. Mentioned, obviously, the positional value with Jordan Brooks, the thought that they overpaid Greg Olsen a lot for a 35-year-old tight end with one healthy season over his past 3 years. Didn't like that they went for so many linemen as opposed to, you know, kind of consolidating that money on a second stronger option than Brandon Schell. And he suggested Brian Bulaga as an alternative there. He does seem more optimistic, I think, than most Seahawks fans are about the chances of Jadeveon Clowney returning.
Okay. I mean, if you're ranking this, you said 26.
Yeah.
The 26th best offseason, and you're positive about the chances of Clowney returning, that's pretty frightening, because then if he doesn't return, does that mean it's the worst offseason?
Unclear how much that would change.
I mean, I'm at this point, I'm considering it an extremely low probability that Clowney returns. And I do think this is a... I don't want to say unmitigated disaster of an offseason, because I don't think it's that. I don't know if the team is markedly worse going into next year necessarily, but they also at the same time are most decidedly not confidently better. There are players on this team, you know, like they've definitely got bodies, and they're bodies who may have been competent NFL players at various times, but like I don't look at it as like, well, they can replace Clowney because they signed Bruce Irvin and Benson Mayoa and traded up for a pass rusher in the second round. You know, like none of those things equal one of the best players in the league at quarterback pressures last year. So like the idea that there's just, if they re-sign Clowney, I think this is a top 15 offseason or top 20 offseason at the very least. But like if they don't re-sign Clowney, then they've lost one of the best pass rushers in the NFL for no fucking reason at all.
Yep. I mean, that's the swing, and like you still, it's hard to grade their offseason at this point because it's just such a big uncertainty out there. Although like you, I'm not optimistic about their chances of re-signing Clowney.
There are times where I see people who are being like, Clowney isn't an elite pass rusher. And I'm just like, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills, you know, where I'm like, what is the metric that you're looking at to assess that?
You know is what it, the metric is they're looking at to assess that.
It's just sacks.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the only number that you care about this, where it's like, all of the disruptive stuff that Clowney does, you just completely ignore that and only care about one number. Where it's just like, I really believe that the people who are saying this comment, who I've seen, who I sometimes think they're smart football people. And I think that the Seahawks would be smarter than this. Care about pass rush win rate a little bit. Where he was in the top 10 in the league, right?
Yeah, I think so.
This is a repeatable skill. I just don't. Fuck it. It's been a terrible offseason. Who cares?
You talked yourself into it.
No. It has been. Without Clowney, this has not been a good offseason.
Yes. I also want to shout out the latest Flying Coach podcast with Pete Carroll. And Pete Carroll and Steve Kerr were joined by Michael Lewis on this week's pod to discuss coaching and you know what he's written about that. And it was a really interesting discussion. They got into the role of player development, and Carroll talked about how he is probably guilty of being overly optimistic about being able to coach up players that the Seahawks draft or acquire, when that was something Michael Lewis asked specifically about, which is no surprise to any Seahawks fan.
I call me when Chris Ryan's on this podcast. I haven't listened to it yet. I have not listened to a single episode.
Michael Lewis is a pretty compelling podcaster. His own podcast, Against the Rules, Season 2, covering coaching, is quite compelling as well.
Oh, wow. He has a podcast about coaching.
Yes. It's not necessarily just strictly sports coaching. It's also coaching, like life coaching, that sort of thing. But
interesting.
Really good discussion.
It feels, because I like Steve Kerr, and it's almost like I just don't want to hear Pete Carroll, though, you know? Or it's like I might feel more confident about Pete Carroll as a person if I don't hear him talking about things. I feel like I'm not listening for self-preservation purposes.
It's not like there's anything new here from Pete Carroll. Like surprising us. I find it generally positive.
I'm trying to harken back to the days of when we were reaction potting to a 6-6 tie and still feeling pretty good about Pete Carroll.
Well, should we go all the way back?
Oh no, I want to hear about this rewatch first before we go all the way back. How was the Seahawks Cardinals 6-6 tie rewatch?
I missed most of the first half because I had a friends happy hour.
You're hanging out with Mina. You're just daily just rewatchables, personal rewatchables with Mina.
This no celebrities. There are no names I can drop from that group, sadly. So I didn't get like the whole frustration element of it in the same way as I know that we did in real life, like in real time. But yeah, it was some pretty bad offense, and the defense was really quite awesome in that game, along with the special teams coming up with huge plays to help the Seahawks pull out that tie. That was the Bobby Wagner.
Pull out that tie?
You got to pull out that tie. Well, the funny thing about it is, like, our analysis afterwards, we were like, look, it was a home game for the Cardinals. And now it's like, oh, the Seahawks always win in Arizona, except for that one notable exception. Always beat the Cardinals in Arizona on Thursday Night Football.
Oh, God.
And then they always lose to the Cardinals at home, which they, I think, did in fact do that season.
Was this the year that they lost on Christmas Eve to the Cardinals, or was that earlier?
That was not this year, I don't think. So this was the tie. Ultimately, like, if Steven Hauschka hits that field goal at the end of the game, the Seahawks would have hosted the second, right? They would have got the number 2 seed.
And they lost to the Panthers this year.
Oh, no, this was the year they lost to the Cardinals on Christmas Eve.
Oh, so they still had a chance of getting the 1 seed that year, right? Or at least getting the 2 seed in a bye week. So if they beat the Cardinals in that game, they most likely are getting a 2 seed.
I mean, they would have. They tied Atlanta and had the tiebreaker because they had won on the non-pass interference on Julio Jones earlier that season.
So if either they win that game on Christmas Eve, which they should have won easily, that was the game that Lockett hurts himself, or, God, just,
man. I wouldn't use the expression hurts himself.
Okay, but yeah, that Lockett gets injured. Or Hauschka makes the, like, extreme gimme field goal in Arizona. They get the 2 seed and a bye that year.
Yes, although obviously Chandler Catanzaro missed an equally easy field goal earlier in overtime. It really was.
Who is the 1 seed? Enough.
Who was the 1 seed that year?
Did Carolina go to the Super Bowl?
Atlanta went to the Super Bowl.
Oh, this was... Oh, did they? Because they hosted the game because the Cowboys lost, right? The Cowboys lost to the Packers, and so they hosted the NFC Championship.
That checks out.
So that was the Dez Bryant game, I think. In an alternate version of the world, the Seahawks host that NFC Championship game. Wow.
Against the Packers.
Oh, my God. Oh. Wow.
There you
okay.
go.
Jesus. That Christmas Eve was up there with, like, worst Christmas Eves of my life.
Seahawks have ruined a lot of Christmas Eves.
They really have. And
Christmas's Eve?
That was up there with the worst Christmas Eves of my life, partially because of a Seahawks loss. And earlier that season, they played a 6-6 tie. Oh, God. Why do we even watch football?
Okay. They did beat the Patriots on Sunday Night Football that year.
I know. It was so much fun. Was that the very next week?
It was not the very next week. There was at least one game in between, because the day before the election, they beat the Bills on the Richard Sherman cheating in the end zone play. There was actually two games in between, because they lost at New Orleans in week
Richard
four.
Sherman cheating in the end zone play?
Where Tyrod Taylor was outside the pocket and Sherman like just basically knocked over a receiver, which is legal, but no one knows that rule, so they got all upset about it, remember?
Kind of.
Just, you know, cheat hawks.
Yeah, just as long as there wasn't an illegal bat.
That was Detroit, right?
Yeah, that was Monday Night Football against Detroit.
This was also a Monday Night Football game, that Buffalo game.
Hmm. Okay,
they lost the next week at New Orleans on the Jermaine Curse OPI.
Oh, my God. Let's take it way back for Pete, though.
Okay, now we're going to take it way back.
Yeah.
All the way back. To the year 2010. It's time to let's remember some years sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza for 2010.
Because Pagliacci Pizza is entering a new decade, and so are we.
There you go. A brief aside to talk about our sponsor, Pagliacci Pizza. Tried out the new seasonals earlier this evening.
There we go.
And two
all
very...
of them? Both of them?
I did. I went half and half. Yeah. A very strong pair of seasonals right now that they just got on the menu. The asparagus prosciutto and the barbecue chicken.
That sounds great. So you ate asparagus.
I'm okay with asparagus.
Wow, this is hashtag growth for you.
I've eaten asparagus for a long period of time.
Look, you're doing the ESPN Daily, you're eating asparagus. I don't even know who you are anymore.
I feel like you do.
I'm going to ask Mrs. Fantasy Genius here. Do you think asparagus is a food that Al would eat? Oh, wow. God, we need to get her a mic. She said, no, but I feel like he's had a food glow up recently.
Have I? Huh.
I at no point would anybody describe almost anything involving you as a quote-unquote glow up. Also, nobody would describe anything that way since 2017. But... now she's mad. Now we're having a...
real insight into the fabulous Tristan marriage.
Fabulous Tristan marriage. But I'm pretty skeptical. What else do you consider as part of his glow up?
His situation he was making the other night with his spam soba.
Oh, when he was making spam masubi or whatever?
Oh, I'm on a cooking glow up for sure during the quarantine. That's no doubt about it.
You're on, you eat tomatoes now? No, you don't.
No, still not.
Yeah, no, he said he does not eat tomatoes. His glow up is not as profound as you think it is. He's an extreme sub Anderson Paak levels.
Anyways, all these two great Pagliacci options for a limited time. Neither of them with a traditional tomato sauce, an olive oil base on the asparagus
prosciutto. I bet you like that, didn't you? That they didn't have a tomato sauce.
I like tomato sauce. But then barbecue sauce is the base on the barbecue chicken. So
there we go.
It's nice to mix it up.
That sounds great.
I would tell you that before this, I think I had settled on my go-to Pagliacci order.
Really? What was that?
I built my own.
Okay.
With traditional tomato base.
Oh.
Kalamata olives, spicy pepperoni from Salumi, I think.
Okay. Yeah, of course.
And then chicken. I went with that.
I think that's pretty fast. I feel like the PSR, where you do the S instead of sausages, salami, I feel like that's... Man, that ricotta is pretty hard to compete with on a Pagliacci pizza.
That is a good point.
Okay, so 2010, we talked about taking it all the way back for Pete Carroll, all the way to the time of his hiring as head coach of the Seattle Seahawks.
Yes, last week we talked about Jim Elmore's ill-fated one season as coach. They also that season fired GM Tim Ruskell midway through the campaign, leaving both roles open, and were able to lure Pete Carroll away from USC with the title of vice president of football operations as well as head coach. Carroll, as part of that search process, agreed to choose a GM from four finalists selected by Seahawks president Todd Lewicki and picked Packers executive and one-time Seahawks executive earlier in his career, John Schneider. And here we are a decade later, that partnership still going strong.
I want to say that I remember the day that Pete Carroll was hired. I don't know if I do exactly, but I do remember us being very excited about it. Whereas, like, he was the coach of the 2000s in all of college football. And, like, this wasn't somebody who – Pete Carroll felt like he could compete at the higher level. There are some – like, honestly, if you tomorrow are, like, you put Dabo Swinney in the NFL, like, he's going to fail. You know, I just do not believe – I think there are certain coaches that are, like, perfect at being big fish in small ponds. And Pete Carroll – and maybe this is hindsight saying that because he has won a Super Bowl since then and been a successful NFL coach. But, like, he felt like somebody who was bigger than the college game in a way that some of these other coaches just do not. And the same with – I think Saban could be a successful NFL coach. He is a college coach at his core. And, like, I just think Pete Carroll connected with players – on a way that was so much deeper than the way that I think a lot of college coaches do. He's not a control guy, right? Like he's not the type of coach who's trying to like lock down every aspect of a player's life. He can handle NFL players. Dabo Swinney cannot handle NFL players in that same sort of way. Whereas like Pete Carroll was ready for this and waited for the right opportunity where he knew that the organization would put the kind of resources behind him to be able to completely overhaul the team and has this like history and built-in fan base. Like there were a lot of good things for Pete Carroll coming into this job.
On the West Coast, he had a relationship with Tim Leiweke at that point because he was still at AEG in LA, you know, not directly working with Carroll, but he was like the contact point between his brother Todd and Carroll. I think Nick Saban would be a really good NFL coach if he actually committed to it and got this kind of power over an entire organization. I think that was a big difference between when he was in Miami and, you know, Pete Carroll's experience in Seattle. I think it's different with if it's a career college coach like Sweeney or who was the other guy the Dolphins hired who was from like Arkansas? Oh, Bobby Petrino. Mike Riley's ill-fated Chargers run. I think that, but like Carroll had worked in the NFL for a long period of time, just like Nick Saban had been a defensive coordinator.
He was an NFL coach who happened to be coaching in college is really what it felt like.
I mean, it's interesting though that, you know, I think I would recall being excited about this as well, but I was reading Danny O'Neill's piece in the Seattle Times that said the Seahawks fans were not gung-ho about this.
About Pete Carroll?
Yeah.
Because they hate winning? What?
I think that there was skepticism based on his NFL career, which is seen as weirdly negative. Like, I get that he took over a team that had just gone to the Super Bowl in New England and that the team slowly declined, but he also went to the playoffs 2 out of 3 seasons in New England. It's talked about as if, like, they went 0-16 every year, the way that people talk about that time.
Even his Jets tenure wasn't terrible, right?
No, I mean, I think they were 7-9, maybe 6-10. And that was probably their best record in the next 5 years.
Pete Carroll was, I feel like he was maybe a little bit ahead of his time with what he was doing and the earlier stints that he had in the NFL. He also is not like, it's ironic because now he's sort of evolved into an old school NFL guy in a lot of ways. But I still feel like personality wise, football wise, he's maybe one of the oldest school coaches there are. But like, personality-wise, he connects with players. He is a player's coach in a way that I just don't know if New England and the New York Jets were able to handle at that time, and it was such a perfect fit at a place like USC. where I remember the first time that I was just like, oh shit, Pete Carroll's awesome, was there was a 60 Minutes feature on him when, you know, at some point during his USC tenure, and he was talking about like going into inner cities and like hanging. And I saw that and I was just like, holy shit, Pete Carroll's the best. You know, it was one of those things where he was always sort of the Huskies' foil, but like we didn't hate Pete Carroll at USC. You know, this wasn't like a Jim Harbaugh type situation where we hated everything about what they represented and stood for. It was just like USC was so much better than UW that we weren't playing the same sport. You know, like even when we beat USC, it wasn't like, well, we finally took down Pete Carroll. It was like, thank God we won a game. You know, right? Like it felt totally different. This wasn't Chip Kelly.
I suppose so. Yeah, I mean, we were also very excited for Sark at that point. There was, I can't remember the Pete Carroll feature. There was a feature that followed him on one of these trips, similar to that 60 Minutes profile you're talking about that really won me over, I would say, in the standpoint. It's interesting, Art Thiel, I mentioned on Twitter part of his piece from during the Super Bowl year, or the championship year, looking back at the Carroll hiring, talking about how it came together. And one of the things that was mentioned in that was that the A Better LA was a big factor for Todd Leiweke.
Really? Wow. So do bullshit press pieces, people, because they matter. Fluff press pieces, big deal.
Now people just do podcasts. So Pete Carroll and Schneider then turn their attention to completely turning over the roster of this 5-11 team they inherited, making 284 transactions during the first year. That can't possibly be true. There's only 53 spots on the roster.
284 transactions.
The first draft class for those two in Seattle yielded Russell Okung with the 6th pick, Earl Thomas with the 14th pick, as we mentioned last week, acquired from Alphonso Smith, or for Alphonso Smith from the Broncos. Golden Tate in the 3rd round, Cam Chancellor in the 6th round. That's a pretty fucking good draft class.
Absolutely. When a lot of those didn't, I think Okung and Earl definitely were factors right away. I remember wanting Golden Tate to be good right away, and he just could not get on the field. He was the Top Pot Donuts guy early on, right? And it was
Now it's something very different altogether.
Oh, we still love Golden Tate.
No, we do not love Golden Tate anymore. We do not at all love Golden Tate.
Why? Because he said that Russell Wilson wasn't the best quarterback he played with?
Yeah, I think he said it while wearing a red hat.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Whew. Anyway, Cam Chancellor, such a draft pick. 5th round, come on.
Wow, Mike Williams was the leading receiver by a wide margin that season. Man, 2010. So the Seahawks beat the 49ers 31-6 in Carroll's debut and started 4-2, I should say, before losing 7 of the next 9 games. However, that still left them in position to win the NFC West with a Week 17 Sunday Night Football showdown versus the St. Louis Rams with Charlie Whitehurst at quarterback in place of an injured Matt Hasselbeck. He can drive any machine to its limits. He couldn't necessarily push the Seahawks offense to its limits, but they did beat the rookie Sam Bradford 16-6 to win the division at 7-9 and host the defending Super Bowl champion Saints in the wild card round. Is maybe the largest underdogs ever to host a playoff game. Matt Hass came back from injury to throw 4 touchdowns, and Marshawn Lynch, who was one of those 284 transactions when the Seahawks traded for him in Week 5, all but sealed the win with the Beast Quake to give the Seahawks an 11-point lead with 3:22 left as I was enjoying the Husky game with the famous cousin Kenny.
God, I remember you describing this, right? Because didn't you say that there was just like a murmur through the crowd at that Husky game after this happened?
So it was late enough by this point that, you know, like people could stream the game, and so everybody was at slightly different points. So people got the touchdown run, like this pocket of fans was seeing it, and then this pocket of fans was seeing it. It was like an amazing moment.
I mean, being there actually was an amazing moment, too.
Oh, you don't say.
It was one of those plays where you're just like, oh, he's down. And then you're like, oh shit, he's still running. Or there's sort of like, there's such a chaos that happens when you're watching a football game. And if there's a play where it's like sort of, you can't really tell. And then all of a sudden somebody emerges where you're just like, what is going on? And then he's jumping into the end zone. And I feel like that's even part of why the crowd erupted so much, because it was this moment of just like, what's happening? And then all of a sudden you see him scoring or breaking free and you're just like, oh my God. And sort of the instant reaction of it, where it wasn't like, we couldn't see the whole play develop in the same way that you might like the Jermaine Curse touchdown to go to the Super Bowl. Like, you can see the whole thing and you're just like, that's going to come. Then we're going to blow up. This is just like, he's probably down. And then all this stuff happened and it's craziness, but then he's still up. And then there's all of a sudden Marshawn Lynch is scoring and we're going to beat the Saints, who at the time, like, I mean, I think still to this day, beating the Saints is a big deal, but like, the Saints were the team in the NFL at that point, right? These were defending Super Bowl participants, at least, you know, the defending Super Bowl champions. So this was like, beating the Saints really, really mattered. I mean, this is like Tennessee taking down the Patriots this year, or something like that, you know? In fact, it was almost exactly like that, except Tennessee did it on the road.
You say this as if the Huskies beating Oregon State 103-72, getting 14 points off the bench in 16 minutes from Terrence Ross, 7 boards, was not also something.
Uh-huh. We talk about that game to this day. We call it the bench quake from Terrence Ross.
The bench quake. So the Seahawks then went on to, for the third consecutive playoff trip, after winning at home in the wild card round, went in the division round to play in the Midwest, and same result, played against the Chicago Bears, fell behind 28-0 in that one before a late comeback made the final score respectable, behind 2 touchdowns in the final 2:16 while trailing 35-10.
I sort of remember that comeback, but not really. I mean, it was clear that this was, and honestly, like, the foundation of the team was there, but the team, even despite, and I have to give a lot of credit to Pete for this, despite the fact that they did win a playoff game, Pete and John recognized that this was not the team. Like, this was not the team that was going to lead them to a Super Bowl, and they recognized that it was going to be Matt Flynn eventually.
Not Tavares Jackson. Who did lead them to a Super Bowl, technically speaking.
Absolutely did. But that they were able to win a playoff game and not say, okay, we're good. Right? Like, let's run it back.
Because they were always competing. I mean, by the way, we should touch on here, like, for some reason, Seahawks Twitter decided on May 18th to rehash the "Is Pete Carroll a good coach?" discussion.
What happened? Yeah, what
I don't know if it's just because of the quote I posted that Ben retweeted. Pete Carroll, I think it's fair to question whether...
If you can bring that up.
So it's from that Arteal feature I mentioned where he's talking about his time in New England. Carroll, according to one source, never got over the March 1998 loss of 5-time All-Pro running back Curtis Martin
there
in Carroll's first year with the Patriots. Martin left in free agency to the division rival Jets in a 6-year, $36 million deal. That was my best player, he told people then, bewildered, figuring the Pats could have found a way to keep a game-changing talent.
I know we all want to just like laugh at Pete Carroll here. Football was totally different when this happened. Like,
it was. It's just funny.
You would never, ever, ever blame a coach. And you said this was 1998, right?
When he left, it was, yes, after the 97 season.
You would never blame a coach in 1998 for being like, a running back is my best player.
I mean, Seahawks were paying a lot of money for Ricky Waters then.
It is a totally reasonable take for 1998. Like, we have to have some cultural relativism here. As, like, we could look back on this 20 years later or whatever, 22 years later, and be like, ha, 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 he thought that a running back was the best player. But, like, this sport, the game was played differently at the time, as it were. And also, like, the way that people valued players. You know, there were tons of running backs drafted in the top 10 and paid shit tons of money. after that. Like, people valued running backs. And also, he went to a division rival, and I think had some pretty good seasons for the Jets.
I mean, look, we can debate whether Pete Carroll is the right coach at age 68 for a Seahawks team whose best player is their quarterback.
Yes.
But we cannot debate that Pete Carroll was the right choice for the Seahawks in 2010, and that none of the great things that have happened over the past decade happens without the starting point of hiring him and John Schneider.
Yes.
All right, let's talk about the Seattle Storm, who won their second WNBA championship in 2010. They added vets Svetlana Obrosomova and Laco Willingham to a healthy starting lineup, and everything clicked for the Storm after five consecutive losses in the first round of the playoffs. The 2010 Storm started 9-1, and then after losing their second game, added a 13-game winning streak that lasted more than a month to push to 22-2. I remember being very nervous at this point because I was looking up all the best starts in Seattle history and noted, or like all the best single season records, that sort of thing, and noting none of those teams ever won a championship. It was like, it's the 2001 Mariners, it's the 94 Sonics. There was a Sounders team in there in the NASL days that had started really well but not won the NASL title. So I was very concerned. Storm got the biggest win at the time in WNBA history by a 111-65 final over an outmatched Tulsa team in August, and then won the final three games with nothing on the line to tie the WNBA's single-season record at the time with 28 wins. Lauren Jackson was named MVP for the third time in her career, and Brian Agler was voted Coach of the Year. The Storm easily swept away LA for their first series win since 2004, playing the Sparks in the first round for the third consecutive year.
Wow.
Then came from behind at Phoenix to sweep the conference finals, coming back from a 12-point deficit with 3:20 left on a 15-0 game-ending run, capped by Sue Bird's three-pointer to break the tie with 2.8 seconds left. One of my all-time favorite Storm games since I was there in Phoenix for that one.
Was this Lauren Jackson's best season?
2007 was her best season individually. This was like the best combination of LJ being healthy and at her peak, and then like the Storm being really good defensively with Brian Agler and Sue being very good. Like everything just worked that year. Swin Cash was healthy and playing quite well. This was an awesome team.
Yeah. Lauren was awesome to watch play basketball. I feel like almost gets kind of forgotten in Storm history, even in a way, but like, because Sue Bird has been around for so long, but like, Lauren Jackson was like the Rain Man to Sue Bird's Peyton.
I mean, Sue's longevity is so big, and then she hit a lot of big shots. We're going to talk about a couple more in a second, another one in a second here. Like, the greatest player in Storm history has got to be Sue, but at the same time, like, Lauren is a greater player in WNBA history, and I don't know how that makes sense.
Lauren Jackson was a better player for the seasons that she played than Sue Bird is. But, like, Sue Bird played for so many more seasons. That's what I'm saying. She was the Rain Man to Sue Bird's Kemp, or to Sue Bird's Peyton. Like, the Sean Kemp, his peaks on the Sonics were higher than Gary Payton's peaks.
No, like, that's not true. When they were both on the Sonics, Sean Kemp was the better player.
You talk about the 96 finals. Sean Kemp was better than Michael Jordan in the 96 finals. Gary Payton was a better Sonic all time, but we love both of them. But there's a special place for players who, and I don't want to say that Lauren Jackson burned out, but like she didn't have the tenure that Sue Bird has had. And I mean that
almost no one has.
Few players have had the tenure that Sue Bird has had, which is why it's special. But like, there's something even more special about watching a player who was probably clearly the best player in the WNBA for a period of time.
I mean, I was 19 when Sue Bird was drafted.
Sue Bird has never been the best player in the WNBA. Is that true?
No, not particularly close.
She's never been particularly close to the best player. Whereas Lauren Jackson was the best player in the WNBA.
Yes. You can make a case that nobody's had a better single season than Lauren's 2007.
Is it the same with Breonna Stewart?
That Breonna Stewart has been the best player in the WNBA?
Yes. Didn't she win an MVP? It's pretty wild. I mean, there's just not a lot of teams but like that Sue Bird has been able to go from having so in a similar they play sort of similarly to going from one like forward slash center who can also shoot, who is one of the best players in the WNBA, to another one in a span of whatever 10 years.
Okay, so I want to touch on this game. We went down there to Phoenix the night before, watched the UW football game, which we'll talk about in a minute here. And so it's the day before Labor Day, and when the Storm are down 12 with 3:20 left, I'm like, we're like all pissed off that we have to work on Labor Day and prep for Game 3 of this series, and like then the Storm might lose, that all that sort of risk. And it was such a thrilling comeback when they came back to win this one. And get to back to the finals. We came back and went out to Aussies back when Aussies was still located along Aurora. And then several Storm players showed up and hung out there because that was like Lauren's go-to spot. So
is it great? Wait, did Aussies move? You're talking a different place.
I'm sorry. Not Aussies. Kangaroo and Kiwis.
I was going to say, I was like, Aussies has never been on Aurora.
Aussies has always been in Queen Anne. Yes. Kangaroo and Kiwi moved from on Aurora to now along like Market Street and Ballard.
What you meant to say was Aussies.
Yeah, that is why I probably got it confused in my head. Aussie. Oi, oi, oi. Yes. Anyways, on to the WNBA Finals. All three games in the finals were close, but the Storm won game one on a Bird tie-breaking jumper with 2.6 seconds left, where Lauren Jackson said, one of the most amazing moving screens in WNBA history, really left tackle-esque.
That's all right. Reggie pushed off on the shot against Jordan.
Well, yeah, there's a few push-offs in the last dance that was on last night.
You got to see the other angle.
I don't think it should have been a foul. And then in game three, Atlanta missed two tying three-pointers in the final 3 seconds in Atlanta, allowing the Storm to sweep and become the first team to sweep through the playoffs undefeated since the WNBA Finals expanded to best of five.
Wow, they swept the playoffs.
This was, at this point, arguably the best team in WNBA history.
Really? Who is overtaking them? Anybody?
The 2014 Phoenix Mercury came along. They broke their record by winning 29 games in the regular season, also swept through the playoffs, and had a way better point differential in the playoffs.
All right. So fine. There's fine.
Really no credible argument that it's the best team in WNBA history, but it's the best team in WNBA history in my heart.
There we go.
Just the real metric here. Mm-hmm. UW men's basketball reached the Sweet 16. Senior Quincy Poundexter emerges the team leader during a shaky regular season that saw the Huskies start 3-5 in Pac-10 play before winning 8 of their final 10 games, but they then won the Pac-10 tournament, beating Cal 79-75 in the final in a game I do not remember.
Yeah, they played who and what now?
It's kind of been overshadowed by the next year's Pac-10 final, which was a little more memorable.
Oh my god.
So the Huskies may have needed that one. They still, with the Pac-10 tournament title, got the 10 seed and faced Marquette in the opening round in San Jose. Poindexter beat Jimmy Butler off the dribble. A much bigger thing now than it seemed then for the tie-breaking runner with 1.7 seconds
that
left.
I don't even think I realized that was Jimmy Butler until now. Who was it who took the shot that missed to end the game? It was a big player.
He wasn't their biggest player. Lazar Hayward was probably their biggest player, or Darius Johnson Odom, both of whom went on to unsuccessful NBA careers. Neither of them is an all-star.
Jimmy Butler. Oh, my God.
None of whom has been guests on A Touch More with Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe, like Jimmy Butler was.
This was my first ever South by Southwest. So the first ever time that I realized that the first weekend of the NCAA tournament happens, basically, I think timing might have changed of these two events, but like the Thursday, Friday of the NCAA tournament, which are some of the best sports days of the year, are exactly opposite South by Southwest. So if you're going to day parties or whatever, like you're really seeing none of it. You're just watching updates on your phone, and it kind of sucks. Like the worst thing about South by Southwest is I remember there was a huge, I think Texas won a big game on like a 50-foot shot. Like a couple years later, there was like a huge Texas win. And I remember like looking up in a hotel lobby and being like, cool. And there are all these, it's just like these things that matter so much to these people, but you're in this weird bubble of South by Southwest. But so I was there with Third Pelton Brother Reese, my first ever South by Southwest, and we're sitting at like a bar of all these Seattle music people watching the UW game. And it's like the rest of the people, like they quote unquote care. You know what I mean? Like they care about what's happening, but it's like, I really care about what's happening. And it's one of those situations where you're trying to be cool and just like trying to fit in. But it's like, I am going to be personally affected and emotionally affected by the outcome of this basketball game that we're watching at like a shitty bar. So there was that. And then I think the second one, that was the Marquette game was first, right? And then when they beat New Mexico, they just beat the shit out of them. I remember being in a different bar for that one because you're having to like find these awkward spots that are near. Most of the TVs are showing like, I think that one you specifically had to find the game for the first round. Second round is a little bit easier, but being at like, it's like a Texas bar or whatever. I might have even been at like a Texas A&M bar or something for the second round. Maybe it was a Baylor bar. I don't, whatever. Some college in Texas that was not UT. It was like that was who they were cheering for at that other place that we were at, and just like sort of casually watching because the Huskies were winning by so much that I didn't have to stress about it. But I remember Reese saying the coupon game where he was like, if this dude misses the shot, we're drinking shots for the last second shot for Marquette. And then he misses and me and Reese immediately grab shots after that of tequila or whatever. I was like, this is a fucking perfect moment. I'm at my first South by Southwest. UW just had an upset in the NCAA tournament. Like, sign me up for that right now.
It was, in fact, Lazar Hayward who missed at the buzzer. Future first.
That's what I'm telling you. Lazar Hayward felt like their star at the time. We never heard of Jimmy Butler.
No. I mean, Jimmy Butler had like 2 points in that game. Huskies beat Mexico. Yeah.
Who was on the New Mexico team?
Their best player was a guy named Darrington Hobson, who was a second round pick of the Bucks and played like a half a second.
How were they a two seed?
They won a bunch of games in the Mountain West.
Oh, yeah. The old Gonzaga route.
They were like the Huskies were, I think, favored by KenPom going into that game.
I remember, yeah, like not being worried. Where it was one of those situations where you felt like whomever won that UW Marquette game was going to beat New Mexico.
Yeah, New Mexico finished 43rd in the KenPom rankings. What the hell?
Good God.
I mean, they just hadn't played anybody. They had wins over Cal, which was a better team than we realized, clearly. And Texas A&M.
Is this Jerome Randall's Cal team?
Yeah, this is one of the Jerome Randall Cal teams.
Yeah, Jerome Randall's good.
They had a solid team. Patrick Christopher, Theo Robertson, now like, he's an NBA assistant coach, and Jorge Gutierrez, who...
Oh, man, Gutierrez, loved him.
NBA.
He played in the NBA? Oh, wow. I remember really liking him.
So then the Huskies reached the Sweet 16 for the first time since 2006 and were overmatched in Syracuse against a West Virginia team that would reach the Final Four, losing 69-56 as their lack of size was pretty badly exposed in that one.
What seed was here, or was West Virginia that year?
West Virginia was the 3 seed.
So I remember thinking at the time that this was another situation similar to the Louisville year, where they came upon a really good underseeded team, right? Like, that was a fucking good team that they played.
Yeah, it was.
And they were big, too.
Oh, they were the 2. Wait, they were the 2 seed. Wait, do I have all these seeds wrong? I guess the Huskies were the 11th seed, and Marquette was the 6th seed.
Wow.
And so, and then
maybe the separation isn't in the preparation for you.
New Mexico was the 3 seed. This is what I get for not trusting checking this. West Virginia was the 2, but so it wasn't that notably underseeded.
Who was the big man that West Virginia had though? Like he was ended up being like a first round draft pick, right? But was terrible in the NBA.
They had Kevin Jones, who was a second round pick.
I swear they had some like kind of oaf white guy.
Maybe coming off the bench, but not among their starters.
Really? No. Huh. But I just remember this team being like, I guess Deshaun Butler wouldn't have been it, but like they just felt like the type of, they were
I mean, they were so number two in the country in offensive rebounding.
Yeah, they were just, like, so much more advanced than UW. They just felt – like, they weren't a huge team. You look at their heights. But it was, like, they just felt like men, you know? And the Huskies weren't there. Like, this West Virginia team was, like – they were a grown-up team, and the Huskies just weren't. And they sort of arms-linked the Huskies in that game, I feel like.
They went on to beat a 35-2 Kentucky team in the regional final.
Wow.
So – That's a nice win for them. They featured DeMarcus Cousins, John Wall, and Eric Bledsoe.
Oh my god. But, you know, Dalton Pepper got us.
Guys, their starting five is all guys who are still in the NBA. DeMarcus Cousins, John Wall, Eric Bledsoe, Patrick Patterson, and Darius Miller.
DeMarcus Cousins isn't technically in the NBA anymore.
That is true. He's not technically in the NBA.
It was like Wellington Smith and Cam Thurman knocked him out. No, Deshaun Butler was a good player, though.
He tore his ACL in the Final Four game, and then he was never quite the same.
He was never going to be a good NBA player because he was probably undersized for what he did, but like Deshaun Butler for a college player was good.
UW football returned to a bowl game for the first time in 7 years, I believe.
There we go.
Season started with high hopes, but the Huskies went 1-2 in non-conference, losing at BYU and getting blown out 56-21 by number 8 Nebraska. After which, famously, I was
this
someone
was
yelled
the burn
out the
your
window
jersey game. Oh my god!
For me to burn my like Jake Locker jersey, which I did not burn and still have to this day.
What was your response to that, Mrs. Fantasy Genius? She said, "Oh god," because it was Katie didn't go to that game for whatever reason. It was you and me and Mrs. Fantasy Genius, and we were walking along because we parked about a million miles away that you forced us to park at, and. And we were walking, like, it was like one of the off campus housing or whatever on like campus parkway and whatever.
I think technically we were off campus parkway by that point, but yes.
And out the window of some apartment was just a burn your jersey, your number 10 Husky jersey. Oh, it was good. I remember. That was the first time that I really recognized how powerful the Nebraska fan base was. The garbage can game?
We were
no, that was a couple of years earlier.
We were up by Portage Bay. We had just passed Portage Bay when we got.
Yeah, it was around Portage Bay. But seeing the amount of like 40 to 70 year old white people wearing all red who would travel to go see Nebraska. They were very comfortable wearing all red a few years later. But who would travel to go see Nebraska play was like, I remember driving around the city and there's just like everywhere you went, there were Nebraska fans. And I was like, they had this circled on their calendars as like, we're going to go to Washington for this game, beat the shit out of the Huskies and then feel great. This is Taylor Martinez was their quarterback. Is that right?
Oh, this is, maybe, actually. I guess that might have been. But hold on. We can wait on that because Nebraska's going to come up again.
Oh, God.
Believe it or not. No, that's not no God. As it turns out.
But yeah, this was... I remember just like being so frustrated watching this game.
Yeah, that was Taylor Martinez. You are correct in that one. 19 carries for 137 yards.
He was unstoppable.
7-11 for 150 yards in passing in that one. Do you want to know Jake Locker's line in this game?
Oh, God.
Jake Locker was 4 of 20.
He was 4 of 20 for 53 yards. Is that right? Do I have that right?
71 yards.
70,
the 53
oh,
yards
man.
Might have been in the holiday ball. He somehow had, like, Kobe Bryant's Game 7 of the 2010 Finals is his completion percentage in a football game.
Wow. Man, that game was terrible.
That was unfair for Kobe. Kobe went 6 of 24.
Okay, but I want to... Okay, we're not ready to talk music. Let's talk Husky football. When we talk music, I do have a Husky football story.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So the Huskies then won number 32-31 at number 18 USC when for a second consecutive year, Eric Folk hit the game-winning field goal at
freaking
the buzzer.
Wild. This, it was a different USC team, but still pretty crazy to win that one.
I mean, a better quarterback because they had Matt Barkley at that point.
Well, especially after getting throttled by Nebraska, it just felt like...
And then the Huskies lost four of their next five, including blowout losses to number 13 Stanford by a 41-0 final, and number one Oregon 53-16 on the road.
Okay, so that Stanford game is definitely up there with. We talked about there was the pair of Oregon State games 2 years in a row where it poured rain, and I think all of the Husky quarterbacks got injured. Everybody on the roster, legendary quarterbacks got injured. Like there were so many Husky quarterbacks got injured in those consecutive Oregon State games. I was drenched. 41-0 against Stanford at home. You sat in the fucking press box. This was Andrew Luck's senior year or whatever. Andrew Luck's last year at Stanford. And you sat, we showed up late because we were somewhere.
It was not Andrew Luck's senior year, as it turns out.
Did he play another year after that?
I'm pretty sure that the game we went to at Stanford was the next year.
Oh, Andrew my Luck God, in. Kill me now.
We lost 65-21.
Do you remember where we were? Did you show up late too, or was that just me and Mrs. Fantasy Genius?
To the game?
Yeah. We didn't tailgate. We got there. It's like super late to tailgating.
Oh, no.
We were down in like weird parking, like that area in Padelford, but the first level in that like weird section, sort of like off to the side of the first level of Padelford. And it rained harder than it has ever rained in the history of Seattle, Washington.
It rained so hard.
This is the Versus channel. Wow. Do you remember this game? We sat out. It was horrible. We sat outside and I was in the press box drinking hot chocolate with marshmallows. Yeah, Mrs. Fantasy Genius is nodding. It was like, I don't think I've ever hated you more. Then you're just like, oh, I'm up here just drinking hot chocolate up in the press box. And we had to watch Andrew Luck destroy UW 41-0 in the pouring rain. I think we probably left like early in the third quarter.
I would think so. It was 28-0 at halftime.
Oh my God. So there are three games that I consider to be the worst games that we've ever been to.
You don't count the Stanford game when they were winless and beat the Huskies nearly enough.
When Stanford was winless and beat the Huskies?
Yeah, the Richard Sherman touchdown game.
It's more about the experience plus the loss.
It was like very cold and foggy. It was not a good experience.
You're much more bothered by the cold and fog. First off, I love fog. Second off, I'm not as bothered by the cold as you are. Because if we're talking cold, I believe this game that we're going to get to.
We'll get to a cold game.
The UCLA game, right?
That was so cold.
November 18th, 5 p.m. start. One of the first like weekday games in UW history, if not the first, right?
I think it was the first Thursday night game in UW history, is my recollection, yes.
And it was freezing cold.
But that's not what we're remembering.
I'm not bothered
right
by cold. I'm bothered by torrential downpour and being outside in torrential downpour.
You know who else was bothered by it? Jake Locker, because he went 7-14 for 64 yards and 2 interceptions in this game.
Somehow an NFL team said to themselves, let's draft that guy with a top 10 pick.
Oh, boy.
After these games.
So that losing streak left the Huskies 3-6 in needing to win out to make a bowl game. That first of game was against the Bruins on a Thursday night, which I don't remember anything about the actual game. I think there were some interceptions. The defense played pretty well.
They had some like big picks. Oh God, I can't remember the dude's name, but I remember there being some big picks. You and me and Chris Smith went.
Quentin Richardson, not that Quentin Richardson.
Yeah, Q Rich
had an interception return for a touchdown. His Huskies won that one 24-7.
That was fun.
With Jake Locker throwing for 68 yards. How did he have so many games with single digit passes?
Literally a top 10 pick after this year.
It's Jesse Callier 10 for 107 on that one. Not so bad.
Free Jesse Callier.
Okay, so the next game. Still need to win out. They go to Cal. They're trailing 13-10. It's the final play. They're 4th-and-1 at the goal line. Sark, one of the ballsiest decisions in program history. Doesn't kick the field goal. Doesn't play for overtime. We're going to go for it. We're going to win in regulation. And calls God's play, which I believe is a power over left guard.
It's pre-Drake God's Polk. Play. This is God's play. Inspired.
God's play, yes. Chris Polk scores the one-yard touchdown on the final play.
I was at Mrs. Fantasy Genius' grandparents' house, and what was the place that they lived? Port Ludlow, where like it's sort of on TV, and I'm like freaking out as he scores his touchdown with Mrs. Fantasy Genius's like 80-plus-year-old grandparents being there. I'm like, this is 4th and 1. Chris Paul scores it. We're going to a bowl game, baby. It's happening.
Oh, whoa. Had to win the Apple Cup too, and that one was also close, tied 28-28. Before, with 44 seconds left, a touchdown to Jermaine Kearse.
There we go. All he does is score big touchdowns. I'm kind of fired up about this Husky season, despite the fact I have like 2 terrible memories from this year. But like, I'm still like, actually, I have like 3 up there with some of my worst memories of Husky football. The Oregon 53-16 loss. Gone from my mind. It's just like, do you just take that off the fucking schedule playing Oregon at that time period? But like, and maybe even now. But like, there were some fun games this year.
So somehow at 6-6, the Huskies go to the Holiday Bowl. A top-heavy Pac-12 had 2 teams in the BCS, Oregon obviously and Stanford. Oregon played in the BCS National Championship that year against Auburn.
This is the Michael Dyer game? Wow.
Yeah. He was down. But just 5 bowl eligible teams in the entire Pac-12 because of sanctions against USC after Pete Carroll left for the Sox.
Thank you, Pete. Hashtag.
One of those teams weirdly did not play. I think it was Arizona State did not play a bowl game. So only 4 Pac-12 teams were Pac-10 teams. It was Pac-10 back then. There were still only 10.
And we wonder why bowl games. The Pac-12 can't recruit now. Why we have precisely 0 good teams in the Pac-12.
And one of those was the Huskies, who played a 10-3 Nebraska team at 6-6 in the Holiday Bowl, having lost by 5 touchdowns to them in Seattle earlier in the season. And somehow they won!
I really wish that I remember this game better, because it's kind of crazy looking back on it that they won this game.
Oh my god. The passing lines in this game.
Taylor Martinez
7 of 9.
Fucking sucked. Like
53 yards, but he must have been injured at some point and replaced by Cody Green. Who went 3 of 12 for 45 yards. On the Washington side, Jake Locker 5 of 16 for 56 yards in this game. Jesse Callier threw 2 passes, which also, Jesse Callier threw 2 passes.
2 passes.
And had about his third as many yards as Jake Locker did passing. He had 16 yards.
Jesse Callier. He was a lefty passer too, right?
That sounds right. Locker did have 13 carries for 83 yards. Chris Polk, 34 carries for 177 yards.
I feel bad for Chris Polk long term, because they ran his body into the ground at UW.
I don't know that he was going to be a big-time NFL player anyway, but yeah, 260
still,
carries that year, 293 the year after.
Man, this was a fun year. Okay, do we have any more sports to get to?
Yeah, I mean, the Sounders won the U.S. Open Cup for a second consecutive year. They won at Portland on penalties in their first game before cruising past the LA Galaxy in Chivas USA in Tequila, and then beating Columbus 2-1 at Quest Field to lift the Open Cup trophy once again. A slow start to MLS play for the Sounders, who were 4-8-4 at midseason before catching fire in the second half with a stretch of 10 wins in 13 matches before losing their season finale. But still a disappointing playoff outcome for the Sounders, who lost 3-1 to Galaxy on aggregate in the playoffs. And this was the year we saw them on Halloween.
Numerous years we were there on Halloween.
They also finished last in their group in their first CONCACAF Champions appearance. The Mariners that year became Felix Hernandez's team. King Felix won the Cy Young.
There we go.
With a 13-12 record. Chance to save metrics as the M's again collapsed to 101 losses.
It was a real Cortez Kennedy Defensive Player of the Year type season.
It really was. After a promising season and yet another trade for a left-handed ace.
Oh my god, this is Cliff Lee.
He was traded again in July.
They traded Cliff Lee with the intent of retreating him. Okay.
No, they thought they were going to be good. Season also saw the retirement of Ken Griffey Jr. abruptly in June, is covered on the history of the Seattle Mariners that we mentioned earlier. Griffey at the time was hitting 184 with no home runs. And then after the season, really the end of an era, is Dave Niehaus, who we have not talked about nearly enough on this podcast, died of a heart attack at age 75.
Wow.
So, Dave Niehaus, like, never the same after him.
No, I mean, the second most important person in Mariners franchise history. And I think there's monuments to both him and Ken Griffey Jr. at Safeco Field.
Correct. Griffey outside the stadium at T-Mobile Park, for the record. And then Niehaus, the statue, is in center field.
Whew. It was kind of weird that Ken Griffey Jr. wouldn't be in center field. No. Those are the two most important figures in Mariners history by such a wide margin that it's not even calculable.
I wrote a column after that about it was the end of my childhood, even though I was already, by this point, pushing 30.
I'm still waiting for my childhood to end.
That wasn't it?
Tell me when you want to, if you write a Medium piece about it, then maybe...
When you stop playing Super Mario Brothers, that'd be the end of your childhood.
I had a perfect score on Super Mario World, for the record.
Do you want to talk about the Blazers?
I guess. I don't really know if I remember this Blazers team, but...
This was a Blazers team that was really hit hard by injuries, like many of them. Greg Oden was off to a monster start, averaging 16.7 points, 12.8 rebounds, and 3.4 blocks per 36 minutes on 60% shooting when he fractured his patella in December. Joel Prisbilla went down with a patella tendon.
Wow, Joel Prisbilla. Zilla!
The Blazers dealt for Marcus Camby at the deadline to fill their void at center and still won 50 games again, but Brandon Roy had arthroscopic knee surgery just before the playoffs. He returned in Game 4 to help the Blazers even their series with Phoenix, but they lost in 6 in the first round.
Can you Control-C, Control-V, Yusuf Nurkic, and Hassan Whiteside with Joel Prisbilla and Marcus Camby?
You know, Hassan Whiteside remains healthy, thankfully.
But I'm just saying, like, the types of... It's kind of shocking how eerily similar this sounds.
The Blazers, I don't know if you're aware of this, they have a history of center injuries. It goes back before those guys.
All the way back. We heard a lot of Bill Walton on The Last Dance. It's actually kind of disorienting how many major national TV games Bill Walton was calling.
Bill Walton is the soundtrack of the NBA of my youth.
I mean, I think Marv Albert is maybe more, but like...
Yeah. But Bill Walton and the Snapper were there too.
It's kind of incredible how Bill Walton has been sort of relegated to the Pac-12 since then. And now he's sort of like your like wacky uncle. Even on these Pac-12 games, he's always notable being there. Maybe his shtick wasn't quite as defined in the mid-90s, but like...
No, I mean...
He was a little bit more reined in.
But I think that's also a Walton's choice. Like, he doesn't have to travel as much.
Hashtag Walton's choice. Himself.
Walton's world.
Oh my god. Walton's choice.
All right, should we talk about music in 2010?
Well, so I wanted to mention, we're going to talk about Bumbershoot first here for music in 2010. Just because we talked about the Huskies. My one memory of Bumbershoot from that year is we watched the Husky game at BYU against now part of Russell Wilson, whatever camp quarterback. But at the time, notable traitor to us, Jake Heaps.
I don't know if I'd necessarily say that.
We were mad at Jake Heaps for committing to BYU over UW.
Who is we here?
This is a Jake. Look, here's the thing. This is Jake U. You don't not go to UW if your name is Jake. This is the lost Jake in UW history. And Jake Heaps committing to BYU. Jake Heaps was a top 5 quarterback out of high school in the country.
Yeah, he was a huge deal. He played for a lot of different schools. He had plenty of chances to UW had plenty of chances to get him.
But the initial commitment was what mattered. And when he committed to BYU, we were mad about it.
Fun fact. Jacob Eason committed to Georgia first.
Still mad about it to this day. I personally cheered for him to drop.
I wish he would have stayed at Georgia.
I wish Siler Miles was still the quarterback. underrated. He played for Kansas and he played for BYU. How many other teams did he play for?
He finished his career as a grad transfer. He did not actually start. He only threw 12 passes. But at the U...
Wow. Jake Heaps?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
That's what his sportsreference.com page says. I think
he was a grad assistant there. but so we watched this game. It was such a frustrating loss to BYU. And
now I remember I was watching it in Phoenix before that storm game.
I remember watching it and just being – we watched it at Katie's house, me and Mrs. Fantasy Genius. And then we went and met our respective parents at Bumbershoot where Bob Dylan was playing. This was the first year. So they actually, for Bumbershoot, let me be involved in some small regard with booking the festival because just a huge mistake. And I was part of a like minor committee called the Bumber Board where we would advise the buyer for the festival.
That sounds like a name drop.
I didn't even say a person.
You said Bumber Board.
You can't name drop a committee.
I think you can.
Anyway, so we worked with Chris Porter. to sort of like generally advise what the artists that would be booked for Bumbershoot, which for me as somebody who, as you've heard, grew up going to Bumbershoot, was a very exciting proposition. And then I think this was the first day that I had ever been part of this. So I had great passes or whatever. And on that first day, I was furious after a UW game. And I remember going, and because I think it was Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So this would have been the first day of it, of Bumbershoot. I was so upset after this UW game. And we went to go watch Bob Dylan, who played, like, I'd heard about Bob Dylan's live sets. This is the only time I've ever seen Bob Dylan live. They're sort of like sprawling and incoherent in a lot of ways where you're like, what song is Bob Dylan playing right now? You have to listen real close to get a sense of what Bob Dylan is playing because he doesn't play through his hits in the traditional way. It's just like it's free form. And now I can definitely respect it. When the Huskies had just lost to Jake fucking Heaps at BYU to begin another season, I could not respect that. And I went to Memorial Stadium, and I sat in the last row of Memorial Stadium. I went to the entire top of the stadium and sat there angrily and watched Bob Dylan. So anyway, Jake Heaps ruined Bumbershoot 2010. Thanks for committing to BYU. It's kind of funny seeing him on – I don't know if you watch the Russell Wilson Instagram videos, but it's like it's always – Jake Heaps is always just there. And it's like that's the guy who ruined my Bumbershoot 2010. Cool.
Oh, like the training videos that he's posting?
Yeah, like him with Baby Future or whatever, or him training.
Huh.
Jake Heaps is always there. I think they're in a quarantine pod. Outside of that, I feel like 2010 musically – was like there were a couple of very, very massive releases that will last forever. I mean, we had in 2010, talked about Kanye a lot and Remember Some Years, but
I mean, there's a lot to remember about Kanye.
This is maybe not, I don't know if this is my favorite Kanye album, but it's unequivocally the best Kanye album. And Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy is like, I mean, you know, we've heard podcasts about it. We've heard people like Kanye in Hawaii with all these people there is like Jordan's dream team tapes. You know, like we hear about all of these amazing rappers being in this one place, like waking up and like working out, playing basketball, like eating right, all hanging out in this compound in Hawaii, doing like basically making one of the most sprawling records ever. And this is the last time for me where, and I guess for anybody, where Kanye was really, 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 really trying. And it felt like Kanye had something to prove on Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy for this one moment. And it's like sometimes reeking of trying is a good thing. And by the time he got to Yeezus, where it's like I still think Yeezus is a classic album in every way, but it's different. Like Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, every single second of it is so perfectly crafted, and it's so musical in what he's doing.
Is the Uzi Tommy monologue perfect?
Yes. It is perfect. Also the peak of indie rock, because again, you've got Justin Vernon hanging out with like Pusha T and Kanye and Rick Ross or whatever in Hawaii. Come on. Like indie rock has never been better than that moment. But just beginning to end, every single second of it, just musically, was so crafted. Lyrically, musically, everything about it. It was like, I remember I avoided the singles before this. There was, oh my God, the Power, or whatever that song is called.
Power is, yes.
I remember that single coming out.
Song from that.
But I tried to avoid the singles from it because I was like, I want to listen to this as an album because I was a nerd. And I remember the first time hearing, like, I was driving down from my apartment in Renton, hearing Dark Fantasy. And it was just like one of those moments where you hear something and you have so much joy, where you're just like, okay, I'm like, and then it goes into Gorgeous, and the Raekwon verse on Gorgeous is like really underrated as far as greatest rap verses ever. When fucking Raekwon comes in, you're just like, holy shit. Like, Kanye just went and fucking, he upped it a notch, you know? And it reminds me of like Raekwon guesting on Aquemini or something, where you're just like, this is a moment. But hearing that for the first time ever, or as like every single song, all the way down to like Nicki Minaj, who also released another album, her debut album came out on the same fucking day. The album that has Super Bass came out on the same day that My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy came out. It's just like, what an incredible day for music in general that happened. But like, maybe the best record of the last 20 years came out in 2010.
Also, My Chemical Romance.
I haven't heard it, but it probably matters to some people. You probably don't even like My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy.
No, I definitely like My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy.
The easy talk.
I can do without that. Also in 2010, we have Arcade Fire dropping probably my favorite Arcade Fire album, The Suburbs. You have no thoughts on this?
Well, you said it was your favorite Arcade Fire album, so I was giving you space to talk about it.
I don't know. You know, I don't have a lot else to say that. I just feel like I relate to it a lot, because even though we technically weren't in the suburbs, it was a suburban existence.
Okay, for the record. Nah. It's very... we kind of existed right in between. You know what I mean? Like.
Right. We weren't in the city, certainly, but we weren't in the suburbs, technically, either.
We were kind of neither. Boulevard Park is a strange place, full of multitudes. To me, the suburbs, it was like, I thought, I was over Arcade Fire by 2010. I was not, like, it was not something I was listening to. And then I remember there was, I think, the Pitchfork top songs in 2010, and I heard...
By the way, Pitchfork gave My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy a 10.0, right?
Perfect score, wow.
Which I think was might have been the last one before the recent, you know, by my blanket on the recent 10.0 they gave.
Did they give a recent 10.0? I'm sorry, did Blonde by Frank Ocean not come out?
I just read a Ringer piece about this the other day. You'd think I'd remember it. Fiona Apple.
Oh, yeah, okay. But hearing Sprawl 2 on that, I like had not listened to Suburbs. I was like, I obviously know Arcade Fire very well. I was booking the Vera Project at the time. Arcade Fire were playing Key Arena around this time period. Like, I was like, I'm not going to be working with this band, which ironically I ended up being hired by their booking agency, I guess, 4 years later, so it wasn't that soon after. But, like, hearing Sprawl 2 on the Pitchfork top songs of the year, I was like, oh yeah, okay. I was like, all right, fine, I get it. I get why this is amazing. But then also hearing Suburban War in the movie Boyhood was like, when the beginning of that, where like kid is driving through the desert to go to college, Boyhood kid, and Suburban War is playing, and I was like, never. I feel like we talked about this on a podcast before, but like, never has a more perfect album been written for a movie that would come out years later than The Suburbs and Boyhood. Where it's like
the soundtrack to an album that didn't, a movie that didn't yet exist.
When I was saying to you, this was the first ever time that I went to Texas, and like going to Austin, Texas for the first time ever, you sort of like you're intoxicated by the desert. If you're a person who's from Seattle and has never been anywhere near a desert before, the closest was going to Mariners spring training in 1996 or whatever.
I mean, first off, Eastern Washington is desert.
But it's different. Like, Austin feels a type of way that fucking Richland, Washington does not, I'm afraid.
Second off, I think you're intoxicated by the Lone Star.
That too. But, like, you don't go to Austin for the first time ever for South by Southwest or really anything, as far as I know, and not feel like Austin is maybe the greatest place on earth. I mean, think about your first time going to Austin, right? Like, we went to freaking Salt Lake. We're out there. You can bring your own Shinerbach or whatever into Salt Lake. You can just go casually and get the best barbecue you've ever had in your entire life. It's hot all the time.
Not the best barbecue I've ever had, but the best barbecue I've had ever had is a guy who moved from Austin. So, you know,
it's
close enough.
Like, Texas, there's so many reasons to hate Texas. But Texas is kind of, especially Austin, is kind of the perfect place on earth.
And Austin is not Texas.
And so you hear, like, you hear Suburban War and you watch Boyhood and it's just like, oh, it's impossible not to be overcome with emotion by it.
I agree.
And really beyond that, like when I look at 2010, I mean, we have the last LCD sound system that I'll recognize with this is happening before the initial run and the band breaking up by playing 10 shows consecutively at Madison Square Garden. It really is one where, like, there are not a lot of things that stand out to me. I know you're an Expo 86 guy in the same way that you're a Due Process guy.
I mean, first off, the memory of going to Expo 86 is in and of itself so strong that I love... Who else had an Expo 86 song?
Was there another Expo 86 song? Jesus Christ.
Someone else had a song titled Expo 86.
White people.
Maybe it was Modest Mouse.
Love Expo 86.
Oh, it was Death Cab. Death Cab has a song called Expo 86.
You all are boomers.
I've never decided to like that.
I wasn't invited as a one-year-old to Expo 86.
I think you were there. I don't know if we left you home. You just probably don't remember.
All I remember is being stung by a bee at Bouchard Gardens or whatever that place is called.
Yeah, that was after 86.
I said I'm done with Canada forever.
I love that entire album. Another entire album I loved that I have not listened to in so many years, the Broken Bells album, the Danger Mouse James Mercer crossover. Yeah, nothing there.
I've never heard it. I've literally never heard
You've never heard Broken Bells?
I think I remember driving for a second and then turning it on, like the first song, and being like, maybe on Rhapsody or whatever.
I would say also possibly my favorite Rihanna album with Loud.
For me, 2010, what the most thrilling music of the year was. Was a record called a mixtape called Shut Up Dude by Das Racist. And I swear to God, it seems ridiculous 10 years later to be like, this was exciting music, especially from the group that had the Pizza Taco Bell song. But like,
oh, I love that song. I didn't realize that was on this 2010 release.
It did come out earlier, and then Shut Up Dude as like the full mixtape came out after that. But like Leaf, who was also an exciting artist at the time. Like, you can't quantify how thrilling Das Racist seemed in 2010. And, like, this mixtape came out, and it was like songs would just fall apart. You know, this was not professional music in any sort of way. Part of it was almost like stand-up comedy. Hari Kondabolu's brother, Ashok Kondabolu, was, like, the hype man for the group, you know? Like, there was something about it that felt, it was obviously extremely New York at the time, where it's like they understood what they were doing, but it felt super intelligent and felt super aware of what was going on in the like blogosphere world of 2010. and going to, so it was like that EP came out and you're just like, this music might be awful or it might be incredible. And seeing Das Racist at Chop Suey in 2010, it was the most packed show I've ever seen at Chop Suey before. There were so many fucking people in there. And being in the bar, just like so many people wasted at this show. Whereas like Das Racist had a cultural moment. If you would have told me in 2010 that Drake, or if you would have been like Drake or Das Racist will be the most important artist in the world 10 years later, I would have been like Das Racist easily.
Yeah, I would have picked Drake.
I would have been like, Drake's a corporate sellout. He's done. Das Racist is the voice of the future. That's what it felt like in 2010. There was like, literally, this music felt, and within a year, it was just like, the whole thing was done. It burned so hot, and it was so exciting for a second. Whereas like, Thank Me Later, as the Drake debut full-length record, was, it felt a little bit calculated. It felt like he hadn't quite gotten to the like Marvin's Room level of Drake, and he hadn't quite perfected it after that. But it was like Drake is a corporate entity that is on the rise in 2010. I suppose so. Beyond that, there's not a lot else that like. I mean, I think the Janelle Monáe record from that year was very exciting, and the debut of Tame Impala, which I had no idea even happened until I read the notes from you. This was feels like we're only going backwards, Tame Impala. So I was years away from ever paying attention to them as a band, but like the footprints were starting.
It's, you listen to the album, it just sounds like normal. It sounds like all the Tame Impala that was to come.
Does it?
I mean, Tame Impala just has one sound. Like, it's a great sound.
I so fully disagree with that, but okay.
Anything else on music from 2010?
I don't think so. I mean, we can look at the Capitol Block Party if you'd like to, but most people say that they don't want to.
Not a big year for TV. There wasn't really any notable TV debuts.
Was The Walking Dead 2010?
I don't think so.
Is that 2011? October 31st, 2010. And The Walking Dead, that's Halloween if you're scoring at home, literally the same day that we went to that Sounders match, it debuted.
Eating so many hot dogs while The Walking Dead was premiering.
We were living at your house, at Katie's house. Do you remember this?
No, that is not accurate.
Was that the next year?
It was the next year. It was during the lockout.
Okay, so we watched The Walking Dead the next year. So we were a year late on watching it. The Walking Dead has become a horrible, horrible, horrible show that I've not watched in probably 7 years. I think it's still on. I don't even really know. There was a moment at the very beginning of the show that it was also an extremely exciting show, where it was like it felt like, you know, AMC was on such a roll at the time. I think Mad Men must have happened, right? There's like Mad Men, Breaking Bad, stuff like that. Whereas like this felt like it was in line with some of the best television of all time. And ultimately, it was not that, and it was more like a like fucking just trying to stay alive type show. But like the first few seasons of The Walking Dead was a cultural movement for people, and it was like zombies were what we cared about, and it was like what we expected in the fall was to watch the show about zombies and be a little bit scared and a little bit excited and like think about this post-apocalyptic world and what would go along with it. And I remember just having a time where I was like, this is up there with the best shows that I've watched in those first couple of seasons.
Never watched it.
Well, have you ever seen Breaking Bad?
Nope.
Oh, God. Have you ever seen that? Have you seen an episode of Mad Men?
I've seen some clips from it. I don't think about you at all.
You're aware of that line?
I am, yes.
You knew who...
Also, that's what the money is for.
That's what the money is for. God. Well, anyway, Entourage, I'm sure, was still kicking in 2010.
Probably was. Probably was.
I'm telling you that Das Racist and The Walking Dead, if you want to talk about the real experience of being in these places at the time, Das Racist and The Walking Dead were exciting in 2010. And a decade later, we also have The Social Network, which was an exciting thing in 2010.
I mean, The Social Network was like one of the very first rewatchables, right?
I feel like Simmons is trying to push this point of like, this is a great movie. And I remember watching and being like, oh, that's fine. And then moving on with my day. And then they're just like, they'll be like, this is the most rewatchable movie of the last decade or whatever. And I'm like, is it? Eisenberg? Zuckerberg? What are we doing here?
I think you made it sound as if those were two separate stars.
Aren't they?
I mean...
They are two separate people.
They're two separate people, but like two separate stars of this movie.
What has happened to both Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook as a platform in the last, I don't want to say decade because it hasn't been that long, but in the last 3 years or so, I feel like it's impossible. The Social Network is an interesting movie always. The amount that you care about it really is tied to the amount that Facebook is a platform that you're paying attention to. Right? Like, imagine you were watching a movie about the making of MySpace. It's absurd, right? And like, but what is the difference between Facebook and MySpace?
That one still exists.
I mean, I guess so. Does it though? Like, as somebody who pays a lot of attention to what's happening in social media or whatever, I always felt like, it was like, okay, nobody gives a shit about Facebook. Nobody under the age of 40 gives a shit about Facebook anymore, right? I literally had a conversation today with an artist who was just like, I can't remember the last time I was on Facebook. It's been like 5 years. And he's like, I really care about Instagram. And it was like, okay, like as long as Instagram is
still... You know who owns Instagram, right?
Listen to what I'm saying, though. As long as Instagram's thriving, you're like, okay, you can trace it back to the same place. But even now, in this quarantine, I feel like the amount of attention that I see being paid to Instagram vis-a-vis TikTok is like, it is dwindling and dwindling. And it's like, Mark Zuckerberg better open up those pocketbooks and start looking for some acquisitions here to China. Because like, if you don't have Facebook and if Instagram doesn't matter, all of a sudden, like, the amount that Mark Zuckerberg is a person, The Social Network is a film, all of these things matter, it becomes less and less and less. And like, you can see it every day that this is the nature of social media. It doesn't continue.
Even if Facebook dies out as a social media platform, it will still have had a much greater long-term lasting impact than MySpace had. Like, it's still going to be, you can't tell the story of the 2000s in the United States without telling the story of Facebook.
Okay, how about this though? Long-term, do you think we will look back on Facebook as the... I feel like there's a chance that we're like look back on MySpace more fondly because it pioneered the platform. Because
the reason we look back on MySpace more fondly is because we aren't fucking on MySpace anymore.
Well, I've got like some news.
If you were on there every day and having to update your top
anymore, I'm not logged into Facebook on my phone. I literally do not remember the last time I scrolled through Facebook. Do you?
But Facebook still exists as an entity for you to be annoyed by it. MySpace, you can't be annoyed by because it doesn't exist as an entity. Like
you're saying these words in 2020. Say these words to me in 2025.
Okay, I think that Facebook will still exist in 2025. I'll take that bet. If you want to put $20 on it.
Sure, fine, fuck it.
Deal!
I think it will exist in 2025. I'm willing to bet on it because why not? But also...
Because we're pushing 2 hours here?
I don't think... Look, we're just trying to entertain our fans in Ireland. I don't think...
He said an hour and a half. He said nothing about 2 hours.
He stopped listening after 90 minutes. I don't think it would be shocking to me. If you had a crystal ball and you're like, in 2025, Facebook doesn't exist, I wouldn't be like, whoa! Right? I would be more shocked if Twitter...
First off,
Twitter
let's see if any of us exist in 2025.
Twitter, to me, feels like a longer-lasting platform than almost any social media.
Yeah. But Twitter doesn't make any money.
It doesn't matter. It's not going to go away. Just not making money isn't enough of a reason for it not to exist. Or it's I can see a specific value add to what Twitter does as far as social networks, media, whatever goes, that I don't see in Facebook and I don't see in Instagram either. Instagram isn't a news source. Facebook isn't a news source. Twitter is a news source.
I think Facebook is a news source. It's probably a lot of the problem,
it tells you when the protests are going to happen. when the open up Ohio protests are going to happen. That's what news it tells you.
Again, I think people using Facebook as a news source is a significant amount of the problem. But also, Hot Tub Time Machine.
Oh my God. Just, such a film. Look, when we have our Hot Tub Time Machine, if we had it in 2010 to look at 2020 and realize that Facebook didn't fucking matter at all, we've got Cusack kind of making the film legitimate. Craig Robinson, burgeoning star. He'll get there if we have another 3 or 4 decades. That's all that I remember at Hot Tub Time Machine. But I remember it being a pretty fun movie.
You don't remember Bob Corddry?
Oh, some Corddry action. It was almost like, you remember Snakes on a Plane?
I mean, yes, but I don't because I've never seen Snakes on a Plane. I have seen Hot Tub Time Machine.
Did we went together to Hot Tub. I literally went to the theater twice to see Hot Tub Time Machine. I'm there not joking. Go. I think I went to Snakes on a Plane twice also. I'm just really into cinema. But Hot Tub Time Machine was a movie where it was just like, this should not be a movie. And then you go see it and you're like, wait, that was actually kind of good. I like weirdly enjoyed myself watching that outside of like Snakes on a Plane. You're just like, okay, this is a ridiculous thing that I'm watching. But Hot Tub Time Machine, I was like, oh, okay, this is actually kind of a good movie.
I find it hard to explain, to think about the concept of Hot Tub Time Machine in hindsight.
It's that you have a time machine and it's a hot tub.
But that was popular. It's hard for me to understand.
Was it popular? Have you ever seen Inception before?
I have not seen Inception.
Stupid movie. 2010 film. I love that you pulled out just Hot Tub Time Machine and The Social Network.
I mean, those are the two that seem relevant to us.
The year that... Okay, Despicable Me? Anything?
No.
Scott Pilgrim versus the Universe?
Obviously not.
Okay. Quote unquote, obviously not. The first Iron Man, I think that began, was that Iron Man 1? Oh no, Iron Man 2, okay. So this was not phase 1 of the MCU. Well, I think that's all there was. Oh, 127 hours. We had a Franco moment in 2010. Yeah, I don't know. It was, in a lot of ways, 2010 was just kind of an undefined year. It's interesting how when we entered the new decade with 2000, 2001, it felt like there was a very clear divide between the 90s and the 2000s. And I don't know if I would say that that has been true for the, like, 2000s into the 2010s.
I would agree with that. I feel like there is a pretty big, separation between 2019 and 2020 so far.
Yeah, we haven't had a new Expendables movie yet. anything else on 2010?
I would say on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Oh, okay.
I wish that I could be in the headspace that I was in when we were playing Jackbox on Saturday. I was in the fucking zone. You know what I mean?
Hmm. I must have also been in the zone, as we won in an equal number of games.
See, I won all the fun games, though.
You did. You're getting me on Fibbage. I don't like it one bit.
On Fibbage?
Yeah.
The one that I slayed in is the other one. What is the game called? Not Fibbage, but the one where you...
I never know what that game is called.
I'm like the Michael Jordan of that game. I was upstairs. Some of the things are just so stupid, but like, I just understand. I think about it in the way that you write tweets, where it's like you can write one portion, but then if you go to the extra level, then you're like, that's what makes it perfect. You know what I mean?
So the extra part of today's tweet was.
Mine is DJ Planty Boy.
I don't. Why? What did Planty Boy come from?
It's just nonsense. The joke is that it's just DJ and then some random words. That it's not like, you know, it's because people are like, your DJ name is your, you know, DJ and then the street you grew up on.
Yeah.
But instead, it's just like DJ PayPal being a successful DJ. It's just so ridiculous.
Or DJ Old Yummy.
And I like plants.
There's one thing I know about you. Do you like plants?
So I'm DJ Planty Boy. But yeah, you have to tell the joke. Or not tell the joke, you have to add more to it. Because if you just say like one statement, then it's just like, okay, that's funny. But
well, all right. Well, good luck getting back to that headspace.
I thought of jokes. When I was like, the other thing that I think about it is when you do the things, like combining a picture and a caption is not that hard. Writing the caption is and making the picture, the drawing, is so much harder than combining the two.
Well, especially for you. I mean, I'm not good at drawing either, but especially for you.
But Ben said he liked one of my drawings, that there's a cat farting on fire.
Was that the one that you died in Murder Party?
No.
You drew another cat?
I combined those two, but I didn't draw or write that caption. Of Ben with the like Reaper, and it was like,
no, but in Murder Party we all had to draw, like it said, draw the cutest thing you can think of, and we all drew cats.
Yeah,
no. And yours was still
this
horrifying.
Was a different one. I'm freaking terrible at drawing. But I'm good at writing captions. That's the thing. It's like Katie on day 95 of the quarantine, it's fucking gold.
That did go quite well. That's her name now.
So, I thought about it earlier in the day. I was like, oh, I'm going to use this at some point in Jackbox games. You know, you like try to think through the news. You don't do this at all?
No, not at all. It's all spur of the moment.
Think about memes. You got it. You know, I always say, to be honest, just a little thing I like to do. The separation's in the preparation, if we're being honest here.
Well,
I guess you don't agree with that philosophy. It's fine. You know, what you do works for a couple of years. What I do helps you win forever.
I want a complete Jackbox scoreboard.
You're like the McVay of Jackbox. We've figured out your game.
First off, have we figured out McVay? In what sense has that happened?
He didn't make the playoffs last year.
Yeah, do you remember that game down in L.A.?
I didn't say that we the Seahawks, we as the league.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. When it comes to Jackbox and life, the separation's in the preparation, but apparently you don't agree with that. It's okay.
I'm just trying to live in the moment like Michael Jordan was.
You wrote like 3 pages of notes for this podcast. You listed out albums we'll never talk about.
Just had to keep record of them.
I haven't finished the Jordan doc.
Well, there's going to be some spoiler alerts here.
Yeah, don't spoil it. There's so many things where, like, the fact that he hit a shot over Brian Russell the year before, gone from my mind.
Same, yeah.
That's kind of wild, right?
Wait, did they never end up talking about the mailman doesn't deliver on Sundays?
There's a lot of stuff that they didn't talk about. I thought your tweet, because the tongue being out part of it is just like, it's a lot. Like, every highlight, Jordan has his tongue out.
Yeah.
And they once brought it up.
There's only so much you can do.
But even just being like, somebody could have been like, oh, and he dunked on me with his stupid tongue out or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like maybe part of the magic of the Bulls is that they just, every game they won was a close game. Like, they never blew teams out, it seems like.
I mean, they did win by 42 in the finals in 98.
Did they?
Yeah, they held the Jazz to like 54 points.
It feels like a lot of their wins were close, though. More so than the Warriors. Like, the Warriors played a couple of interesting games during their, like, really all we've got is game 7 against the Cavs. And I guess the one game where J.R. Smith didn't know that the game was tied. But, like, there's not that many thrilling, like, Warriors games. At least in the finals or whatever. Because they just were crushing teams.
I think there are more closer games than you remember. Both the game 3s that Durant played in were close.
They went to overtime, is that right? And Durant just, like, killed in the overtime?
No. He just made a bunch of big shots late in regulation.
I remember playing basketball and him, like, knocking down, like, a long jumper and the game being over or something. It's like, damn. But also, Jordan has, like, there's just so many Jordan shots where you feel like you're going to remember these things and then they're just gone from your mind long term.
Yeah.
Like, are we going to think that way about that Kawhi shot against the Sixers in, like, 10 years? It'll be like, oh, yeah.
No,
or you think that was
shot
important enough?
Is into the echelon that you always remember it.
Huh. Or do you think the Bulls won so much that some of their, like, some of the game winners just kind of get lost?
Yeah. Whereas, you know, I don't know if there's going to be other Toronto championships.
RIP Toronto. Oh, I'm ready to record this podcast. Are you going to throw... you should throw the Jackbox conversation at the very end.
Obviously.
I was just having a conversation, and I was like, wait, this is great content. okay.